Look east if you want to visit Europe but escape the maddening crowds of its major destinations in high season. Coming up, we'll look at how the old Eastern Bloc nations have been modernizing and are ready to compete as top-notch visitor attractions.
It's amazing the progress they're making, and it just keeps going.
Norway is an interesting example of how to organize a society. They're using the wealth from their oil industry to invest in a future without it.
In the late 1960s, when we found the oil, we had, luckily, a very clever government.
And a journalist on assignment to write about piracy in the Horn of Africa soon found himself at the center of the story when he was held for ransom for nearly 3 years.
What I didn't expect was that they were going to demand $20 million, which was a total shock to me.
Michael Scott Moore tells us what happened. And we'll take a closer look at Central Europe and Norway in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Michael Scott Moore was mostly known for writing about surfing in Southern California, until he went to Somalia to write about the rampant piracy in the Horn of Africa and got taken hostage himself for 977 days. He tells us how he endured the ordeal a little later in the hour. And a guide from Oslo explains how Norway uses its oil revenue and its taxes to fund social benefits that rank it near the top among the world's wealthiest countries. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves, looking at the emergence of what we're going to call Central Europe. The discussion among travelers in Western Europe lately is how to manage the unprecedented crowds. Well, a great way to avoid the crowds is simply head east. The Slavic countries, ranging from Poland to Croatia, are a world apart from so many European travel dreams, but when you travel there, you realize what an exciting and rewarding world awaits those who venture in that direction. What has been called Eastern Europe, but which we're now calling, more accurately, Central Europe. Cameron Hewitt, the senior researcher at Rick Steves Europe, has long spearheaded our guidebook work there, co-authoring a number of guidebooks to the region. And he joins us now to get us up to date on the region and to explain why we're changing its name. Cameron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Yeah, first of all, I implied there's no crowds in Eastern Europe, but you were just there. What's your take on that?
It's definitely less crowded than some of the mainline kind of Western European hotspots. Prague is always popular. Prague is always going to be crowded. And other cities to some extent. Croatia, if you're there in the summer, the beaches can be pretty packed. But in general, it is still certainly less discovered than some of the other places in Europe.
Now, I see you brought a book called Rick Steves' Eastern Europe, and that's
yes.
About 1,000 pages, and it's called boldly Eastern Europe. And we've had this has been an interesting thing. For 10 years, our friends in Eastern Europe have kind of gone, come on, you guys, we're not Eastern Europe, we're Central Europe.
Yeah, I'm holding the 10th edition of that book, and we decided a long time ago we're going to call these countries. So the countries we're talking about are Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, Croatia, Slovenia. So these countries that are just on the western edge of what used to be the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
And for years we've said, you know, when our American customers and readers and viewers think about those countries, they think Eastern Europe. But the people who live in those countries would say, we are not Eastern Europeans, we're Central Europeans. And you and I have kind of been debating for years, like, is that, you know, are our American customers...
Our marketing sensibility
exactly.
trumps the truth sometimes.
Yes, are our American readers going to understand what that means?
In my Cold War orientation.
Yes.
Because you're a generation later than me.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was just Cold War city, man. There's the Iron Curtain. It's East communist and West capitalist. But if you're really properly going to talk about Eastern Europe, what countries would those be?
Well, then we're getting in farther east. Now, Russia is technically Eastern
former
Europe.
Former Soviet
former
Union.
Former Soviet,
you
right?
Got
so
Ukraine, Georgia,
Belarus, Georgia. Yeah.
And Russia going all the way to the Ural Mountains.
Exactly.
Which is probably about as much territory as Western Europe.
Yeah, and if you look at the true continent of Europe from Spain all the way to the Ural Mountains, the countries we're talking about are right in the middle.
Yeah,
square
central,
in the middle. Yeah,
Central
Europe. Yeah.
So then what does that make Germany? I guess it makes it west.
Yeah, central is, yeah, Germany's the tough one, right? So, you know, we like to think of it as Western Europe. You could certainly call Germany Central Europe as well. But just for our purposes, in terms of our guidebook, we like to think that that doesn't necessarily include Germany,
but
Central Europe.
Czech Republic is actually west of Vienna, which we think of as west.
Yeah, Prague is actually west of Vienna. It's west of Stockholm. It's west of a lot of Italy. If you look at a map, most of Italy is actually east of Prague.
Yeah.
And so, you know, geographically, this is correct.
So wish us well. We're going to change the title of the book and our way of thinking to Central Europe, which is true to the people who live there. And that should be the defining thing is,
what do the people who live there call themselves?
And it's interesting. We posted a couple times about this on social media, and you get what I've seen is Americans write in and say, I've never heard of these countries being called Central Europe. And then I get people from these countries writing in saying, I've never thought of myself as an Eastern European.
Right.
So clearly, if you want to go with what they call themselves, that would be Central Europe.
Okay, now you've been to Eastern Europe. You're feeling the pulse of Eastern Europe. You were just on the shakedown.
Central Europe, Rick. Central
That's
Europe.
Right. Central Europe. You were just on the shakedown cruise of our new Poland tour to make sure that it made sense and it was a smart tour and everything. And there's the war going on. And this is the biggest war, I think it's fair to say, in Europe since World War II.
Yeah, or the Yugoslav wars, probably.
Yugoslav wars, okay.
Yeah.
What is the feeling in Eastern Europe in general, or Central Europe, about the safety? Because the numbers are down. Less people are going to Central Europe than would go without the war in Ukraine.
That's right. And I think it was the war in Ukraine that honestly helped us realize that we were using some old terminology, right? Because Ukraine is certainly Eastern Europe. And I think what's really critical here is that the border between the European Union and non-European Union and NATO and non-NATO, that includes the countries we're talking about. And I think that for me is sort of helps define what is Central versus Eastern Europe. And the invasion of Ukraine was a horrible thing and shocking. And people thought, well, is Putin next going to invade Poland or Hungary? And the answer is it's a much harder hill for him to climb because at that point he's in NATO, he's in the EU.
Yeah.
It's a very different scenario. And so I think this is kind of what emboldened us to say, you know, Central Europe are the countries that are, again, EU, NATO, they're very central to the European identity.
It is interesting because it has been east of the NATO line and now NATO has
shifted east. That's right.
So what is Eastern Europe now is east of Poland, not east of Germany.
It's almost like there's a new Iron Curtain almost, you know.
Almost,
sadly. Wouldn't call it that, but
right. But the point is there any reason to avoid Central Europe because of the Ukraine war?
No, and I've been to all of these countries since that war started, and the short answer is absolutely not. It feels very safe and stable there. People there are, you know, like everyone watching with concern what's happening, and they're very sad at what's happening in Ukraine. They don't feel personally endangered, and they're a little kind of mystified at how many Americans are canceling their trips to Croatia or to Prague or to Poland because of a war that's going on hundreds of miles away.
Well, Americans were doing that when we were fighting Saddam Hussein. We were canceling trips to Romania.
Even in Europe.
Cameron Hewitt is my right-hand man at Rick Steves Europe for all things Central European. He researches and co-authors a number of the Rick Steves guidebooks to the region. Cameron shares tales from his own adventures in Poland, Hungary, Romania, Slovenia, and Croatia in his memoir called The Temporary European. He also posts photos and thoughts from his adventures over the years at CameronHewitt.com. Cameron, a big change in Central Europe these days is it's no longer Europe's bargain basement.
That's right. I think people still think that these countries are where you go to travel on the cheap. And I'm here to tell you now, some of them are still relatively cheap. Poland is a little less expensive than some places. Mm-hmm. But Croatia, for example, I think you still hear people saying, I'm going to go to Croatia because I want a cheap beach vacation. I'm here to tell you, Croatia is not cheap. And people living there are really feeling sticker shock. There's been a lot of inflation across Europe. And I feel like, according to my friends there, it's even more acute there. And these days, I was just updating our Croatia guidebook. And, you know, restaurants in Croatia in a lot of tourist towns are more expensive than something comparable in Italy these days. A lot of the accommodations are more expensive than in a lot of Western European countries.
Hey, Cameron, what about, what do you call it, nativist policies? You know, the same dynamic we have here in the United States, the Trump base. What's going on in Europe with that?
If you look at European politics, a lot of the bigger names and the sort of more extreme governments in that direction are in these countries, Central Europe. I'd say the main one is Hungary, where Viktor Orban and his party Fidesz have been in control since 2010. And they're kind of the template, I think, in European politics of the sort of extreme that things can be taken to, which is to say, initially democratically elected, but very quickly moved to sort of consolidate power and take control of different agencies and things that used to be more impartial are becoming politicized and exerting control over the media. And it's not just me, a lot of international observers, the European Union, the U.S. government are looking with concern at some of what's happening in places like Hungary. And as someone who's traveled there a lot during both periods when people on the right were in control and people on the left were in control, we're kind of in some unprecedented waters where it's starting to kind of reshape society and stack the deck in a way that's uncomfortable and starts to feel less than fully democratic.
Because when you own the judiciary.
Yeah, exactly.
And then when you can deny elections.
Influence the media, have actually control over the media in certain ways. There's been a lot of rewriting of textbooks. You know, the government in Hungary wants to rewrite the textbooks that are used throughout the whole country to a to a version of history that's more favorable to their worldview. These sorts of things are alarming.
So does that impact travelers? You just were in Hungary. You're in Poland. What is it like for a traveler?
You know, it's interesting. I try to keep an open mind. And again, I've been there through all different political times. The thing that strikes me the most is travel is about people-to-people interactions. And you learn so much by just meeting everyday people.
Yeah.
And those interactions don't change that much depending on who's in power. And I think that's kind of what you travel for.
Uh-huh.
And what's very interesting, too, is if you just watch the news, you think, oh, Hungary's being hijacked and everyone there must just be going crazy. When you go to Budapest, and most of the support of this government is not in Budapest, it's in rural areas and smaller towns. When you go to Budapest, people still have very much the same views they had before. And a lot of them completely disagree with this government more than any of us do, you know. And so it's just a good reminder that, you know, people are people and travel mm-hmm. lets you kind of connect in that way.
Are people people even if you're gay in these countries?
That's one thing that is of a pretty large concern, especially in Hungary. They've actually got in 2021, they instituted a new law, a sort of an anti-gay propaganda law.
And don't say gay.
Kind of like a more extreme version of the Florida Don't Say Gay bill. And honestly, that's something to be taken very seriously.
If you're gay, do you not go there or do you just keep a low profile and don't be public?
That's the question. And in fact, you know,
maybe as a matter of principle, you just wouldn't go there.
Some people would feel that way, and I would completely support that. Some people would say, mm-hmm. as I just said, there's a lot of value to be had, and there's a lot of wonderful people there who would support you.
Yeah.
I would say it's entirely up to the traveler. But we actually, for the new edition of our Central Europe book, we've written a new section for LGBTQ travelers.
Yeah. Cameron, we've been talking about a lot of complicated things about what we're calling now Central Europe. Let's just finish with a little bit on the good news, and that to me must be the affluence and the development you feel all across Eastern Europe.
Yes, as someone who's been traveling here in these countries for 25 years, it's amazing the progress they're making, and it just keeps going. You think at some point it'll plateau, but every time I go back, if it's been a year, if it's been 2 or 3 years, there's always new things. There's, you know, new infrastructure, beautiful new squares, old grimy potholed streets get turned into pedestrian zones. They're constantly improving on things. A lot of that's coming with European Union money. There's a new bridge in Croatia, for example, that everyone was so excited about. It's this weird historical footnote that there's a little stretch of the Croatian coast that's actually part of Bosnia. And finally, after years of talking, they built a bridge that allows travelers to bypass this little Bosnian section of the Croatian coast, which means they don't have to stop at border checks twice every time they want to drive up and down the coast.
You know, 20 years ago, I made a TV show about Poland. I guess it's time to update it, isn't it?
I was watching that show, and
it's embarrassing.
I know you've been there, but anyone who hasn't been there in 20 years would have their minds blown by
it's
how different things are.
It's high time we got up to date. Cameron Hewitt, thanks so much for joining us and getting us up to date on that corner of Europe that we now call Central Europe.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Since recording our interview with Cameron, the people of Poland have replaced its far-right conservative government with a coalition that's more in line with the values found in most of Europe. 5.5 million Norwegians enjoy one of the highest per capita income rates in the world. Up next, a friend from Oslo explains how their combination of North Sea oil revenues, high taxes, and social expectations works out for them. It's Travel with Rick Steves.
Zovem se Marijan Krišković i dolazim sa predivne hrvatske sredozemne obale i putujem sa Rickom Stevesom.
So that was Croatian.
My name is Marijan Krišković. I come from the wonderful Croatian Mediterranean coast and I'm traveling with Rick Steves. Once again in Croatian, zovem se Marijan Krišković i dolazim sa predivne hrvatske sredozemne obale i putujem sa Rickom Stevesom.
Norway's oil industry has fueled its growth and its prosperity now for decades. But beneath this famously prosperous surface lies a complex set of challenges for Norway today. The environmental impact of offshore drilling and a reliance on fossil fuels sits uncomfortably with the country's commitment to sustainability, good environmental policy, and climate action. These issues pose critical questions for Norway's future, prompting debates on economic policy and environmental stewardship. Today we're joined by Paul Johansen. He's a guide and a teacher in Oslo, and he's going to give us the local take on this directly from Norway. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, you know, oil's a big deal. I mean, we know that in the United States because people in oil-rich states like Texas or Alaska you know, they have a complicated decision when it comes to, are we going to have a fossil-free future, or are we going to stick to what helps butter our bread? I mean, some politicians, they will just gather people together in states like that, and they'll declare, drill, baby, drill. And that's, you know, good for their politics. But we care about climate change also. Much of Norway has a similar challenge. I think your wealth is based on oil. And what's the latest on the Norwegian take on fossil fuels and the environment, and how you are such a wealthy country to a great extent because of your oil?
Well, there's a lot of debates and discussions going on in Norway about the future of oil and which paths are we going to take. And it's a really complicated question. First of all, because we have become so dependent on oil. About 200,000 people in Norway are employed in the oil industry, and 73% of our export income comes from oil. So we are we're in an oil economy. We're very dependent on oil. So to cut it out, there's no majority for doing that in Norway. The politicians don't seem willing to go that far.
To go that far in abandoning fossil fuel?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a politically dangerous thing to do when 73% of your export revenue is from selling oil.
Yeah, and a lot of jobs as well.
Yeah. You're a small country, 5 million people or something like that, and that employs 200,000 people in that industry. So, wow, that's a perplexing situation because, you know, if you care about the environment, you know, fossil fuel's part of the problem.
It is. What we sort of use as an argument is that we can extract the oil in a cleaner way than many other countries can. Like right now, they're electrifying the oil platforms, for instance. Others would claim that this is just, you know, pure symbolism. It doesn't have a big effect on the big picture. But as a big oil economy, it's hard to stop.
Yeah, you could go back to selling cod. That was your economy in the Middle Ages.
Well, the thing is, we are selling cod as well, and we are selling salmon. Norway is the second biggest exporter of fish in the world after China. But still, we are very, very dependent on oil.
It's still a big deal. Yeah. Tell us about the actual drilling of oil. Is there anything on Norwegian soil, or is it on oil rigs offshore?
So all the oil is offshore. A lot of it is found on what is called the Norwegian continental shelf, which is a fairly shallow area off the southwest coast of Norway. But in the later years, they've been starting to drill further up north as well, which brings us to another controversial topic, and that is drilling in the Arctic as well. We had big debates about that some years back.
Are the oil rigs owned by the government, or are they privately owned?
There's a bit of a mix here. But back in the late 1960s, when we found the oil, we had, luckily, a very clever government, which foresaw that this is going to be a huge income for the country, a lot of wealth. So we need to find ways to keep the revenue in the country. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of taxation on oil business. It's over 70% tax on oil income. And in 1972, the government, they decided to create a company called Statoil, State Oil. Basically, an oil company that was going to be Norwegian owned and that would develop their own technologies for getting the oil up from the seabed.
You know, it's interesting to me that when I go to Scandinavia, I feel like Denmark, Sweden, and Norway are all equally prosperous. But Denmark does not have much in the way of natural resources to compete with oil in Norway. And I don't think Sweden does either. How can the Danes and the Swedes live so well without oil? What's their trick?
So the thing is that the oil money is all put into a fund. It's about $1.4 trillion at the moment.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Norway is still a small economy. So if we take too much of that money and puts it into our economy, then we get inflation. It's not like in the US where you can just print heaps of money and that's okay. The money is just absorbed by the market. Here it doesn't work like that. So we can only use a very small percentage of the revenue every year. That's just economics. So even though we have all this money, we can't use it. But we can save it up for future generations.
What an interesting problem to have too much money.
So that's actually what happened during the late 80s. We had more money than we could spend. So we wondered, what are we going to do with it? So we actually went to Alberta in Canada because they had an oil fund back then. So we studied that, how they did it, and we came up with something similar and have been saving most of the income ever since. So we only use about 3% of the revenue every year. And the rest goes into savings and investments.
Into that fund for a rainy day when there is no more fossil fuel industry. Someday that'll happen.
Exactly.
And you will not be impoverished all of a sudden. If I understand correctly, people who live in Alaska get a financial bonus every year for the oil that's pumped out of Alaska. Is there something like that in Norway where each Norwegian citizen gets free health care because you've got so much oil money?
That it is, yes, we do. We have very strong social benefits here. So we have free healthcare. Like right now, I'm on parental leave, you know, and we have 12 months parental leave. It's fully paid. We have free education. There are good, you know, benefits if you're sick.
Okay, you
can't go to
work. I was thinking that came out of tax revenue, but that really is subsidized to a big extent by oil revenue, huh?
Yeah, you could say that. It comes from taxes, but it also comes from oil revenue. It's a mix.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're drilling down into Norway's issue with its oil industry right now with our guest, Paul Johansen. Paul's an authorized guide in his hometown of Oslo. You can find out more about Paul on his website. It's norwaywithpaul.com, and that's spelled P-A-L. Also, Paul produces some amazing videos about Norway, and they're on his YouTube channel with the same name, Norway with Paul. So, Paul, when you think about Norway's way of designing its society, you have that cushion of the oil revenue, and you have very, very high standards for education, for healthcare, for old age security, for infrastructure. Talk a little bit about what a society like yours, which is small, roughly 5 million people, I believe, with huge challenges by nature to lace together your country with infrastructure, and to take care of your populace. As a Norwegian, what's the dynamic there? What are you proud of, and what are the challenges?
Well, I think there's a very broad agreement here in Norway that we want to have people living all over the country, even in remote places. That's a political decision. So we spend a lot of money building infrastructure. So you can go to a small community in Norway, you find a road there, you find, you know, high-speed internet, you find, you know, maybe a small hospital and a school and so on. So I think this is something we have succeeded, you know, fairly well in. Although it is difficult because we also see a lot of centralization. People want to go to the cities. But so far, I feel like we're managing more or less to keep people living out in the remote areas.
There's a sort of a motif of that, or an example I can think of in Norway. When you cruise the fjords, you see little farms that are on a meadow. That's a big enough meadow to feed a small group of goats or something like that. And they actually have kind of a rope ladder that you climb up to get there almost. And it's totally off the grid. There's a little pier at the bottom. And if they want to get mail, they hoist a little flag and the ferry will stop there. And then also, I was driving to a remote community once, Undredal, famous for its goat cheese and famous for its little stav church. And Norway was drilling this, must have been a 5 mile long tunnel. And I went through there when it was unfinished. There was no painting on the, no lights, no nothing. And I was driving forever through this mountain. And I finally got to Undredal, which is a community of, I don't know, 500 people. And it occurred to me, what is Norway spending to bring the road to this little community? And I thought, there must be some underlying principle that every community gets access by road, regardless of how expensive it is to get there. Would that be a fair observation on my part as a traveler? And would that be paid for not on the practicality of it, but on the principle of it, and just paid for by the extra revenue Norway has to have this high standard?
Yeah, I would say it's on the principle for it, because if you don't have people living in these areas, you will lose the culture of those areas, which is so significant to the country. So that's definitely something that we want to, you know, spend our oil money on, to make it possible for people to live in the remote places.
Because what would happen? Just, can you imagine Norwegian culture without the goat cheese from Undredal?
That'd be terrible. No, I can't imagine that.
That would be unthinkable.
I can't imagine life without brown cheese.
That's... Not just brown cheese, the best brown cheese. Okay, so Norway, the more you study, the more you travel, the more you see Norway is investing in its infrastructure with that underlying principle. We need to keep people scattered throughout the country instead of everybody going to Oslo or Bergen. Also, you said you're on paternity leave. So you get, I understand in Norway, there's maternity and paternity leave. In other words, when you have a baby, the mom and the dad get paid time off, and it's use it or lose it. You have to take that time off. Tell us a little bit about that and why.
Yeah, so we actually call it parental leave. We just say parental leave. I'm on parental leave. It's 12 months total for both the mom and the dad. And then 3 months are specific to each parent.
Oh, it's a total of 12, and each
total
parent
12,
has to take three. So you can't get together and say, oh, you're going to be the domestic and I'm going to make the bacon. No, you have to mix it up. That is a top-down tough love sort of thing for family values, I think.
Yeah, but it gets better because it's 100% paid. But then, for instance, if you opt for just 80% pay, then you can take more time off. So then you're up on 16 months. So some people do that as well. So it's a really nice benefit. You can spend some good quality time with your baby. I'm so enjoying it.
It's enjoyable. It's beautiful living. It's family values. And it's also an investment in the fabric of your society, I think.
It is. And I hear stories about, you know, people, they go, pregnant women, they go to job interviews. They're obviously pregnant. They're going to go into a leave, but they're still hired. So that's not a problem here. That's not something that employers worry about, because they know that that's just a normal thing. People go on their leave, you find someone temporarily, and then they come back again to their job.
What's another dimension of Norway's social policies that you're proud of and thankful for?
Well, I'm very proud of the healthcare system, that we have like a strong healthcare system that, you know, takes care of everyone, so that everyone can sort of feel like a big family in a sense. That's something that I'm very proud of.
So somebody cannot be impoverished by a health disaster where they have to pay so much for the doctor that they really can't afford their house?
No. There's no such thing.
That's inconceivable in Norway.
Yeah, that's nothing I would ever worry about.
I see you're kind of smiling at me now, like, are you kidding? Does that happen somewhere where somebody could get cancer tomorrow and suddenly they can't pay their medical bills? But you have the medical bills covered.
I've had surgery 3 times, and every time I walked into the hospital and I walked out again, and I never received any bill, except for when I pay my taxes. But that's
And you pay your taxes, and they'd be high taxes. But I think Scandinavians understand that they get something for their taxes, and they see you could be worried about your long-term financial security, your healthcare, your children's education, but those are not points of stress.
It's true, and I should add that as an average income earner, I don't pay more than about 32% income tax. And that's the only tax I pay.
32%?
32%. For free education, free healthcare.
This is what I love about traveling, is I meet people that give me a better understanding of issues that are challenging both societies. And I love this idea that we can learn from others, compare notes. And Norway sees an investment in these kind of issues as, I think, investment in stability and future prosperity. Paul Johansen is on the line from Oslo and letting us in on how Norway works economically. Paul offers budgeting tips and advice on when to visit and when to avoid Oslo on his website, norwaywithpaul.com. And Paul is spelled P-A-L. Paul, you know, when I'm thinking about this, I go back to last summer when I got to meet your wonderful family and your new little daughter. And I'm just thinking, as a father, what issues, beyond even the environment stuff that we're talking about, of all these issues that Norway is dealing with, maybe even with the specter of Russia, what is on your mind now as a new father in Norway?
Yeah, I think what worries me the most these days are, you know, the global issues. We see a lot of unrest in the world, and that there's a war going on in Europe, just a couple of days' drive from where I live. And that feels very uncomfortable. It feels like it can escalate, you know, like any wars can. Then you have the situation in Gaza at the moment, which we follow very closely. A lot of power play, a lot of, you know, nations and different groups are clashing together. So I feel like we're in a bit of an unrestful period, at least of my lifetime. So that's something that's on my mind for the future.
And in Scandinavia, I understand there's a little bit of this rumbling from the populist right wing, like in Hungary, where there are people that have an angry base and that they're afraid of immigrants and, you know, the kind of problems that Christian nationalism is presenting our country and countries across the democratic West. Is there any change or concern about that in what is otherwise a very centrist and progressive and kind of peaceful political situation historically in Norway?
I would say that our right-wing party, the Progress Party, are not as extreme as you see in many other European countries, like the Alternative for Germany and the, you know, the one in Netherlands and the one they have in Sweden. So we don't experience the same issues. We have just a small fragment of it, but we don't have a lot of social unrest or anything like that in Norway. It's a fairly peaceful country.
All right. Hey, Paul Johansen, thanks so much for joining us. And next time I come to Oslo, what lesson are you going to impress upon me? What do I need to appreciate more about Norway?
Well, I'm going to take you out on my sailboat. That's the plan next time you come to Oslo, Rick. And we're going to go sailing. So
I would love that.
Like Vikings.
Sign me up, like happy 21st century Vikings. Paul Johansen, thanks so much. Best wishes with your guiding and with your wonderful family.
Thank you. Tusen takk, Rick.
You'll find web links to our guests each week at ricksteves.com/radio. An American journalist describes what it was like to be held for ransom for 977 days in Somalia. Michael Scott Moore tells us his story from the Travel with Rick Steves archives next. It's probably a traveler's worst nightmare, being kidnapped and held for ransom in a faraway country. Somali pirates have made the seas around the Horn of Africa one of the riskiest places to sail in the world. Michael Scott Moore went on an assignment to Somalia for a major German publication to investigate how to put an end to the region's piracy. But he was taken captive by the very men who agreed to be interviewed by him. Michael was held for almost 3 years. That gave him time to understand what kind of people his captors were and to better understand himself, before a hefty ransom payment finally secured his release. Michael explains what it took for him to survive his captivity in his book, The Desert and the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast. He joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell his story. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You were living in Germany in 2011, and then you reported on the trial of 10 Somali pirates. Then you traveled to their hometown in Somalia to research a book on pirates, and you were kidnapped by an armed pirate gang just 10 days into your trip. Wasn't it pretty risky to go there?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I knew what I was getting into. I spent months organizing the trip with my partner, Ashwin Raman, who's a documentary maker, and we spent a lot of time finding security and that sort of thing.
So you had security while you were there?
Yeah, oh yeah. Somebody within their clan betrayed us, I think.
So you're in this town. You're there for 10 days doing your work. What was the town like before everything went crazy when you got kidnapped?
Well, the town was interesting to both of us because it was a boom town. We got there in early 2012, and for the last 6 years or so, which is about the same span of time that Somali pirates had been very active out on the water, it had really expanded. So it was a small crossroads town that had turned into a big, slightly important business hub. So there was evidence that possibly ransom cash was sort of flowing around in the economy. And that's one reason we were there.
The boom would have been stoked by ransom rather than normal industry?
Very possibly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell. It's hard to prove anything. But it was fascinating, especially the businesses that had boomed, you know, not just medical clinics and schools, but also they're called Hawala money transfer centers. Galkayo, which is the name of the town, was this incredible hub for very modern Hawala money transfer centers. And those are very important to pirates.
Now, if everything had gone well, you did your interview and you flew back to Germany, what would you have said good about traveling in Somalia? Was there anything to like about it?
Yes, the people are full of energy. The people are really interesting, and the food is often good. While I was a free man, I got plenty of sort of watermelon and camel meat and stuff like that, and I liked that. While I was a hostage, I sometimes got camel meat too, and that was a high point.
So describe the day of your capture. Suddenly, everything's gone just crazy.
Yeah, Ashwin and I had finished about 10 days of research, and we both felt we'd gotten pretty good material, and so it was more or less time to go home. But flights aren't very frequent to and from Galkayo. So Ashwin decided to go to Mogadishu, which meant a different flight from mine, which was going to Nairobi, which meant we were going to travel on different days. So we went to the airport with Ashwin and put him on the plane. Everything went well until we got in the car again and headed back towards our hotel in Galkayo. And it was on the sort of dusty road between the airport and the town that a flatbed truck was waiting for us. The truck was actually a technical, which means a battle wagon in Somalia, fairly common sight, a flatbed with a cannon welded in the back. And there were maybe a dozen men with Kalashnikovs waiting for us. And that truck stopped our car.
You know that there's a ransom industry. When they took you, did you figure, oh, they're not going to kill me. They're just going to hold me and try to turn it into some money?
Yeah, I knew Somali pirates tended not to kill their hostages precisely because they wanted just money for them. They're not ideological hostage takers. They're just criminal. They just want the money. What I didn't expect was that they were going to demand $20 million, which was a total shock to me.
Journalist Michael Scott Moore is our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. In his book, The Desert and the Sea, Michael tells his story of being held hostage in Somalia for nearly 3 years and how foreign policy and religious extremism combined to make the waters off Somalia among the dodgiest in the world. Michael's on the board of Hostage U.S., a nonprofit that helps families of Americans who've been kidnapped. He blogs on his website at radiofreemike.net. Okay, Michael, so you're taken hostage by these guys. Did they actually have a prison, or how did they, quote, lock you up, and what was your daily routine?
No, they didn't have a prison. They stopped our car with that technical, but they put me in another car once they pulled me out, you know, and they beat me a little bit beforehand, and then we drove off into the bush. So the first place that we stopped was actually a camp somewhere in the middle of the Somali bush that made sense somehow to them, but for me it was completely discombobulating. It was a camp where there were obviously other hostages and a few other pirates.
Western hostages?
Well, I couldn't tell. My glasses had been broken, but they were not Western hostages. Right. They were two fishermen from the Seychelles.
Hmm. Okay, so what did you eat when they got you in your place?
The first thing they gave me was bread and canned tuna. Hmm. And that's something I don't ever need to eat again, as a matter of fact. Canned tuna is disgusting to me now. But that was a pretty typical sort of lunch.
They didn't need to worry about what you liked or what you needed. They just needed to keep you alive, right?
Keep me alive.
Were they cruel in that regard? Was it almost calculated, oh, he just needs water and a little bit of bean porridge and he'll be okay?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was precisely how they treated all their hostages. I mean, really just cattle to be kept alive. They kept us barely alive.
So you were there for 3 years. Was it boring or was it constant fear? How'd you pass the time?
Well, it was both.
Yeah.
It was boring, but especially at the beginning, I was in fear all the time because I wasn't sure what was going to happen.
Right. You had a lot of time to think. What did you think about?
First of all, I thought about my family, and I wondered what they were going through. And also, I thought about my past. I mean, it's interesting how once something that traumatic happens to you, you sort of go back in time to try and figure out exactly how you got there. I mean, for me, it was a couple of pretty obvious recent decisions. But I went far back in time to figure out why I hadn't become a doctor and why I became a writer and all that kind of thing.
Wow. Did you decide you have to have a strategy to survive and you had to rethink, okay, how am I going to get through this?
Sort of. I wasn't sure I was going to get through it. I mean, at some point after a year or more, I think I simply lost hope that I would get through it. And that more or less helped. It didn't help my mood, but trying to maintain hope would have been difficult, would have been impossible, because that was one thing that the pirates actually wanted me to do. They kept saying, well, you're going to get out in 2 weeks or a month or so and try and keep my hopes up. But then they would be dashed after 2 weeks or a month. So that was a very, very big psychological problem.
So you're living with these captors who have complete power over you. Did you have any thought of empathy for them? I mean, were they captives in a sense as well, or were they just thugs that were power hungry and merciless?
Yeah, both. They were thugs, but they were also captives in the sense that they were locked into those prison houses along with me. I was held in a series of prison houses as well as on a ship. They couldn't come and go as they pleased. They were forced to live there and watch us 24 hours a day.
Yeah. So it's a sense like being in an army. You can't leave an army historically. You're just captive of the army.
It's a lot like that. Yeah, exactly.
You wrote about how they were stoned on narcotic cud and blasted music from their cell phones. They must have been annoying.
They were. Almost every pirate I met was addicted to khat, which is a leafy drug that Somalis like to chew, and people in that part of the world from Yemen down through Ethiopia and Kenya also like to chew. Muslims in particular like it because it's not alcohol. So one of my pirates actually called it the Somali beer. Hmm. And every one of my guards, you know, the high point of his day was when the khat arrived and they could sit down in front of this pile of leaf and just start chewing for several hours.
Did it occur to you that maybe you could chew it with them and be a comrade, or was that like not the way of thinking?
Oh, they wanted me to. I mean, they pushed it on me.
Did you try it?
Sure. I mean, most of the time I resisted it, but a couple of times I would have, you know, three or four stems. You chew the stem rather than the leaf. The first effect is it makes you high, so it's a little bit more like a coca leaf at first, so you feel better. Your mood improves. You know, if you're a little bit ill, you feel better, and if you're depressed, you feel a little bit up. But these guys need so much of it that they get extremely hopped up on it and sometimes very agitated until they just crash and then fall asleep and then wake up depressed.
Hmm. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Michael Scott Moore. His book is The Desert and the Sea. It's talking about 977 days captive on the Somali pirate coast. Now, what did they want? I mean, is it simply money? There was no revolutionary or political or religious agenda, or were they angry at a certain kind of foreign policy, or was just this was simply employment for them?
No, the religion was there, and when you dug, I mean, I asked questions. So when you pushed, you found it, you know. And I was actually surprised to find that most of my pirates were religious. They prayed five times a day, and after a while, I challenged one of them and said, "You're not acting like a Muslim. You say you're a Muslim and you act like a Muslim, but you're not acting very kind. You're sitting here acting pious while you're holding a hostage." Eventually, he gave me a justification for that. He said, "Well, we don't actually think that stealing from infidels is theft." I thought that was an interesting interpretation, especially for a Sufi. Most Somalis are Sufis.
That is. They spoke English?
Yeah, they spoke a little bit of English, so we could get by with my few words of Somali and their few words of English.
Did you make any friends among them?
Not quite friends, but, you know, we knew our boundaries, our limits, but there were a few that I got along with because they were just more open. And one of them in particular, Boshko, the one who I asked about his religion, he had a good sense of humor. So actually, we got along on a certain level.
You wrote you're a lapsed Catholic, but you found relief in reading the Bible. How so?
Well, on the ship, so after a few months, they put us on a tuna ship that the gang had captured on the ocean. They anchored it off Hobyo and put me and one other hostage on in the middle of April. And we met almost 30 other hostages, and five of them were Filipino, and they had Bibles. And so one of them gave us a Bible to read and said, you know, you can pass the time that way. And I hadn't read anything in several months, so I devoured it. At first, I was looking for something that wasn't quite there in the Bible, you know. I was looking for direct wisdom and direct non-contradictory advice, but the Bible is full of mysterious contradictions. Mm-hmm. But it did help. It sank in, and it did help, you know, almost 2 years later. By then, I was being held on land in these prison houses. I had a radio, and I heard the Pope say something on the radio that was actually quite relevant, because by that time, I was in a terrible sort of vengeful state of mind and near suicidal. And the Pope said something about mercy that helped me sort of alter my thinking a little bit. And eventually I managed to forgive my guards, which actually helped me survive.
Michael Scott Moore is telling us how he survived 977 days as the captive of pirates in Somalia, which he writes about in his book, The Desert and the Sea. Michael describes how his captors reacted to the release of the movie Captain Phillips during his captivity in an extra to this week's show. You can hear that at ricksteves.com/radio. What was the darkest moment?
Well, there were plenty of dark moments, but at some point they decided to chain my feet at night, so I couldn't sleep without having the chains on my feet, and even then it was difficult to sleep.
When you're that exhausted, does your body give you sleep, or do you be endlessly sleepless?
you get sleep, but you dream about home, and then you wake up and you're still in Somalia. So it's really unpleasant. And you can barely move without the chains moving on. You know, the chains wake you up. So that was miserable. And by that point, I was sort of losing that sense of hope and losing that attachment to hope as some sort of a relief or some sort of a balm.
You wrote quite poignantly, hope, it turned out, was like heroin for a hostage, and it could be just as destructive.
Exactly. So in other words, if you tried to cling to this hope, this feeling that kept you above the waterline, you plunged below the waterline into a depression that felt very dangerous. And you could only do that cycle a few times before you realized that you had to detach yourself from the cycle altogether. So hope was counterproductive.
Michael, about the kidnapping industry, basically it's a big industry and Americans are very profitable. If you can grab an American, you get a higher ransom. How did they connect with your mom? How did they give the price? How did the negotiations work? How did you know when your mom got the money and she paid it that they would get it and that they would then release you? They could take the money and keep you.
Sure. Yeah. No, I didn't know any of that. Nobody knew where the first phone call was going to go. When I first got captured, the FBI turned up at my mother's house as well as at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Their offices in Washington, they had given me a grant. Also at the Spiegel office in Berlin where I worked and some family members in Germany. So not the FBI, but the German version. So those were several possibilities. And after about a week of captivity, which for me was an incredibly long time, the pirates put a phone in my hand and said, call somebody. I said, well, I need my notes so I can call the Pulitzer Center. I didn't name any institutions, but I said, I need my notes so I can know who to call. I said, just call somebody. Call your, you know, wife. Call your mother. Well, I remembered my mother's phone number, so I called her. And she sounded terrified on the phone, but she'd had a week to think about it and to listen to advice from the FBI. So actually, she knew the right questions to ask. And everyone was, of course, completely bowled over by this $20 million demand. Mm. But that's how we wound up calling my mother.
And then your mother said, that's impossible. And they said, well, how about $5 million?
The negotiations didn't start right at that moment. The pirates threatened that if they didn't get the money in 24 hours or whatever, they were going to starve me. Nobody took that seriously, and I wasn't starved. But within the next few weeks or something, the negotiations continued, and she made a counteroffer of something like $8,000, which made my heart sink when I heard it.
Mom, come on.
Actually, I was proud of her. It made my heart sink, but I was proud of her. Mm-hmm. It was the right answer.
Okay, well, you came up with $1.6 million. She scrambled that together somehow, quite heroic, I would imagine. What's the mechanics of it? How do you give money to captors, and how do you know they're going to let you go? They can just take the money and keep you.
Yeah, she scraped that up not just herself, but through donations from family and friends and various magazines I'd worked for and that sort of thing. The money had to be delivered in cash. It arrived on a plane. I'm not exactly sure who delivered it, but... It arrived a few hours before I was delivered to a bush plane, a pilot who'd flown in to get me. And the pirates knew what the drill was going to be. The question is whether they were going to adhere to to all the agreements. But one part of the Somali pirate business model is that once they make an agreement, they tend to stick to it.
Because they want to be able to be credible for the next hostage?
For the next event, yeah, for the
next
case.
Oh, that would make sense, wouldn't it? So if they were dishonest about it, people would stop giving them $1.6 million next time around.
Exactly, yeah.
So the day you got on that bush plane and they let you go?
They brought me to a couple of middlemen. I think I switched cars twice that afternoon. And then the last car brought me to the airport, the same airport where I'd said goodbye to Ashwin. And there was a Cessna waiting for me and... really a great pilot named Derek, who I've gotten to be friends with in the meantime.
So what was it like to be free?
Well, I can't say it was elation. I was still confused. I was still extremely weak. I was still very disoriented. That went on for a few days. But once I realized I was going free, I think all that heaviness started to lighten up in stages. And I think one car at a time towards the airport, I started to realize it was getting more and more real and more and more believable that I was going free. And once I saw Derek at the airport, I thought, oh my gosh, this is real. The most incredible feeling was that it was actually ending without gunfire. I thought that negotiations were stalled and so stuck in the mud that there was no way I was going to get out without violence, an American Special Forces team coming in or something like that.
Right.
if that had happened, there was a good chance I was going to get killed, you know. So I was not convinced I was going to get out alive until I saw the plane.
So you're home, you're free, you're healthy, life goes on. You've given your mom a big hug and reminded her you're worth more than $8,000.
Right.
How are you different now after this ordeal when you look back on it?
I think that practice of learning not to hope anymore has sort of persisted. So in other words, I don't look too far into the future. I certainly don't live for the future anymore. That's actually not a bad practice. And I think also a Stoic idea that helped me while I was there, which was you tend to ask yourself when something bad happens, why me? And the Stoic answer is, well, why not you? That notion also helps you sort of detach from whatever might be ailing you at the time.
Michael Scott Moore, The Desert and the Sea. Thanks for sharing your ordeal, and I'm glad you were able to tell the story.
Me too. Thank you, Rick.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Casmara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. You can find links to our guests, listen to a podcast version of the show, and search the archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Monday Night Travel. It's a weekly travel party, and you're invited. Zoom in and have some fun learning about Europe's art, history, culture, and food over drinks and snacks. It's free, it's an adventure, and be careful, it can be addictive. Join me and my travel buddies over Zoom for Monday Night Travel. We're live every week, starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Register at ricksteves.com and BYOB. Monday Night Travel. It's a weekly travel party, and you're invited. Zoom in and have some fun learning about Europe's art, history, culture, and food over drinks and snacks. It's free, it's an adventure, and be careful, it can be addictive. Join me and my travel buddies over Zoom for Monday Night Travel. We're live every week, starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Register at ricksteves.com and BYOB.